Welcome to Credits Due, a podcast where we break down an actor's filmography one movie at a time. I'm Ben Cron.
And I'm Tyler Owen.
If this is your first time joining us, we are on part five of our series on Keanu Reeves, where each episode we discuss a select work from his filmography. On today's show, we'll start off by catching up with a couple movies that he did in between the last movie we discussed, and then we will dive into some trivia on tonight's movie, and then we'll do a full spoiler-filled discussion on the movie. Today we're talking about The Matrix.
Indeed. So do we want to go through, there's actually quite a few movies that came out between our last podcast, Johnny Mnemonic, and today's discussion of The Matrix. So on his IMDb page, we see he has in 1995, A Walk in the Clouds, which neither of us have watched yet, but that was a married soldier returning from World War II to pose as a pregnant woman's husband and to save her from her father's anger and honor. And so that's I would assume that's one of his first, like, real, just straight up love stories, correct?
Yeah, I would say so. I think earlier he did a movie where I think it's kind of a romance, but I think he played a very small part in it.
Oh yeah, I guess he has a few others here too. Yeah. Yeah, and then after that, he did a film called Chain Reaction in 1996, where he starred with Morgan Freeman, and they were two researchers in a green alternative energy project who are on the run when they're framed for murder and treason. Neither of us watched that one either. He went on to do Feeling Minnesota in also in 1996, and The Last Time I Committed Suicide, which is one that you actually watched, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this movie kind of jumped out at me when I was looking through his filmography, mainly because it stars Thomas Jane as Neil Cassady, who is a beat poet in the 1940s. This movie kind of revolves around The attempted suicide of Neil Cassady is like one of Neil Cassady's lovers, and it kind of jumps between two timelines of, or two time points of, before the attempt and after the attempt.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a good movie.
Well, the poster says it's Keanu Reeves' best performance yet.
Whoa. I would have to agree. Well, no, I would have to disagree, but also I don't think he's done a lot of good performances, so maybe they're right. Keanu Reeves plays Harry. The IMDb says Harry, but what's his... I don't know his full name, but basically, Keanu Reeves only shows up... He's like Neil Cassady's, like, best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he only shows up to, like, play pool. Like, there's several scenes where they're in a bar just, like, playing pool and talking about, you know, life and all that stuff. And then, you know, Thomas Jane goes off and, you know, does whatever else he needs to do. And so, you know, Keanu Reeves is second billed, but it's kind of one of those movies where it's a very large cast, mm-hmm. and it's just everyone's interacting with Thomas Jane, who's the main character. So no one really gets a lot of screen time outside of Thomas Jane. But I don't know. Maybe it's just me. But it's like, it's the 40s in New York, and it's like that, the beat poetry, like that generation. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you've seen, like, there's a lot of movies about this time period, and everyone's talking like they're constantly writing poetry, like they're trying to sound as smart as they can. I don't know if the movies just can't capture that, or if I just hate how people talk. But this movie was pretty rough to get through.
It sounds almost like the way you're describing it, it sounds like almost a adapted stage play in film form. Does it kind of have that set up to it almost?
Yeah, it kind of is. It kind of is. I don't know. It's based off of a letter that Neil Cassidy wrote to Harry, Keanu Reeves' character.
Okay.
And I don't know if this work has been adapted to. I mean, it does actually feel like a play. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really just a lot of people talking about stuff, you know, about different characters and about life and all that stuff. If you're looking for, this is not a Keanu Reeves performance that I would point out as a must see. Mm-hmm. And he's not in the movie enough that I would say that you should see it. If you're a Thomas Jane nut, I don't know how many people out there are, but I mean, he's in the entire movie. He's probably in almost every scene. Huh. And he's pretty good. I mean, he's a great actor.
Adrian Brody is in this as well, huh?
Yes, Adrian Brody, and it's not because he plays a character named Ben, but Adrian Brody is actually pretty great in this movie. Huh. It's probably only because he's in like three scenes, so maybe he just doesn't overstay his welcome.
Sure.
But yeah, I watched this on Amazon Prime, so if anyone out there has Amazon Prime, I mean, I guess it won't cost you any extra money, but
it will cost you time.
It will cost you time, and that is very valuable. But yeah, I would not suggest watching this movie.
All right. Well, then in 1997, we had another Keanu Reeves film, The Devil's Advocate. And this is one that I think we had considered putting on our official review list for the podcast, but we ended up cutting it out. The Devil's Advocate is a Keanu Reeves vehicle, similar to some of his other films, where he ended up kind of being the lead casted role, but then he really, really wanted this to be a great film, and so he actually gave up a good portion of his income to ensure that Al Pacino would be cast alongside him.
Oh wow!
And so I think this was pretty well received at the time. It has like a 65 on Rotten Tomatoes and like a 7.5 on IMDb. So, I mean, it's decently well respected as a film. It's not great, but he's actually okay in it. The one thing that I would say is a little bit weird is he takes on a Southern accent for his character, and he kind of like flips in and out of it at will. Like, you can't really tell if he's meaning to do that as part of his character, because the movie is he's a lawyer in Florida who's really, really awesome at his job, and he ends up going to work for a high-end law firm in New York City, and the boss is Al Pacino, and he's this very weird, charismatic, kind of creepy dude, and the whole thing is that it's almost like this Al Pacino character is kind of enticing Keanu Reeves to kind of come to the dark side, like embrace his inner demons a little bit. He wants to kind of turn him into something that that doesn't care about sin or anything. Like, it's a very strange setup, and it's actually kind of intriguing. But then the whole movie just kind of falls apart towards the end. And I'm just going to say, for those of you who want to watch the movie, I would recommend it. It's interesting from a Keanu Reeves standpoint, and it's not a bad movie. But if you want to go watch it, like, maybe skip ahead about 30 seconds because I'm going to spoil the ending. But the ending of this movie is so brazen and bizarre. The Al Pacino character turns out to be the literal devil.
Nice.
And he is trying to convince Keanu Reeves' character, who turns out to be his son, to join him and have sex with his half-sister, who is also the devil's daughter, so that together they can have the Antichrist.
Yikes.
And this all plays out in about a 5-minute long, like, shouting climax where the two of them are, like, just going at it with the most monologue-y monologues I've ever seen. And the whole movie loses all of the, like, goodwill that it built up over the whole rest of the film. The rest of the film is completely, like, it's actually really tense at times. Charlize Theron plays his wife and is really pretty awesome in this.
Oh.
And it's kind of this, like, descent into madness throughout the whole rest of the movie. But then they just go out in and hit you over the head with the, like, oh, yeah, he is literally the devil, and he's going to explain his master plan. So, yeah. It's not great, but it is good. I'd say for the first, like, 3/4 of the movie, it's totally worth watching.
Does that twist come out of nowhere?
No, I mean, they really do. There's definitely demonic stuff that's teased and hinted at. There's actually a little bit of horror element to his wife's plot, where she kind of devolves into madness as he is working his way up the chain in this company, working for this law firm. And, you know, she's having, like, strange visions of stuff. But it becomes pretty overt at a certain point where you're like, oh, these things are really happening. And it's not just, like, somebody having hallucinations and stuff. So it definitely sets up that's maybe what it is, but they leave nothing to the imagination as far as, like, what I feel like if this movie were made today, they would basically just cut out the entire last, like, 15-20 minutes.
I might have to watch that.
It's worth watching.
Twist kind of sold me.
Yeah.
All right, and that leads us up to The Matrix, right? Anything else you want to say about?
Yeah, I'm glad I watched it. I would have been interesting, I think, to have a full discussion on it just because of that crazy twist. But yeah, it's if you're a Keanu Reeves fan, definitely go check that out.
Okay. All right, let's get into The Matrix. It came out in 1999. It is directed by the Wachowskis. It stars Keanu Reeves, Lawrence Fishburne, Carrie-Anne Moss, and Hugo Weaving. Is about a computer hacker learns from mysterious rebels about the true nature of his reality and his role in the war against its controllers. God, that's a great log line.
That is.
Let's start off with some trivia.
Yeah, so I thought I'd throw a little wrench into our trivia that we've been doing for the last few episodes and do something a little different this time. So we're going to do this, rename this segment as Fib Trivia. So, Ben, I am going to quiz you. I'm going to give you four pieces of trivia about The Matrix, and you're going to have to tell me which one I have invented whole cloth.
Okay.
All right. So
three of them are true.
Three of them are true, and one is not.
Trivia, and one is false.
Yes.
All right, let's do this.
Okay. Trivia A. The character of Switch was originally planned to be played by androgynous actors. In the real world, it would be played by a male actor, and in The Matrix, be represented by a female form, hence the name Switch.
Oh.
Trivia B. Sandra Bullock turned down the role for Trinity because she couldn't see herself acting alongside the actor the studio had intended to play the role as Neo. This was before Keanu Reeves was cast, and she later regretted her decision. Trivia C. Warner Brothers originally refused to greenlight the project with its proposed budget of $80 million unless the Wachowskis would adapt it into a Terminator movie due to the perceived similarities of the story. And trivia D. To prepare for the scene in which Neo wakes up in a pod, Keanu Reeves lost 15 pounds and shaved his whole body to give Neo an emaciated look.
Ooh. All right. I want to say the second one about Sandra Bullock is false.
Is that your final answer?
Oh, God. yeah, final answer.
That is actually true. I thought you might pick that one because of the kind of coincidence of them having been in our review of Speed together. But yeah, it's actually C. So there's a partial truth to that, that the Warner Brothers refused to greenlight the project with its original budget of $80 million. But I invented the part about them wanting the Wachowskis to adapt it into a Terminator movie.
Yeah, you threw me off. You threw me off there because I've heard that first fact because, they proposed an $80 million budget and the studio gave them $10 million.
Yep.
And in the most baller move ever, they went with the $10 million and filmed the first scene.
Yeah, the Trinity scene.
Yeah, which I think is Trinity escaping from the agents, mm-hmm. and I assume it ends with her in the phone booth.
That would be my guess,
disconnecting.
Too, yeah.
Yeah. And the story I read this on, they didn't say if that was what they filmed for that was ended up in the movie or if they reshot it or not.
Yeah, I don't know.
I assumed if they spent $10 million, that was...
yeah.
But, and so they took... The Wachowskis took that scene, the opening scene of the movie, back to the studio, and the studio greenlit them for the original $80 million.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. I haven't read a whole lot into that. I read that as well, but I would have to imagine that they really... They kind of designed that whole sequence to be a great proof of concept for the whole rest of the film because it hit that opening sequence has the, you know, patented bullet time rotation with Trinity's kick move. And it really, I feel like that had to have been really impressive at the time because, I mean, it was really impressive seeing it in theater. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Do you want to go back to the other two trivia points and talk about those?
Yeah, sure. So the first one, I picked out a few that I didn't know. I didn't know the Sandra Bullock one. And the first one, I had just heard reading some trivia for this today. And yeah, the character of Switch was originally going to be a dual actor role where... the woman who ended up playing the character in the film was originally, she was only trying out for half of the role. She was going to play the female form in The Matrix. And I thought this was actually really fascinating considering that the directors, both the directors have actually gone through transition to be female now. And I can't help but see like that's it would have been really fascinating to see that represented in the movie, but basically the studio convinced them to change it, which is kind of disappointing because that I think that whole concept of the in the Matrix you are represented with your internal projection of what you want yourself to look like. I thought that it would have been really fascinating for a male character to project themselves as female in the Matrix, but unfortunately that wasn't left in the film. So.
That is interesting because they kind of keep with the androgynous look, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't think it's I don't think you're supposed to question what gender Switch is, but she does kind of have a slight androgynous look to her.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's just a holdover from the design of the character when they were, you know, originally kind of coming up with that idea. But yeah, I mean, I kind of wonder what the alternate universe version of this film would have looked like with that character change. But yeah.
Yeah, very interesting.
And then, yeah, the last little bit there, which I kind of kept in as a easy one, Keanu lost 15 pounds and shaved his whole body for that scene where he's waking up out of the pink goo. So,
yeah, pretty nuts scene. And yeah, he does. I totally believe that he lost a lot of weight because, he looks crazy. And I think he shaved like all of his hair because,
yeah, he
isn't
didn't
he, like
have
missing eyebrows?
Or
yeah, it's crazy.
Yep.
all right. Any trivia left?
That was it. So, let's get into it. I thought we could start off with, since this is kind of a, pivotal science fiction movie, I'd love to hear like what kind of impact this movie had on you personally when you first saw it, and what kind of, baggage do you have going into this movie?
Well, it was funny because, I mean, obviously, yeah, this is a very pivotal movie in like all senses of like me as a moviegoer, me as a person who loves science fiction and like comic books and just like anything. And I haven't seen this movie in a long time. I don't even remember the last time I saw it. This series, I think a lot of people, this series kind of lived its life like when it was in theaters, like the franchise, I mean. Mm-hmm. I think once Matrix Revolutions, Revolutions came out, the third one.
Yep.
I think everyone was kind of just done with that movie, with the whole franchise. I probably watched The Matrix again when I was in college, I'm sure. But, I mean, that was like, it's probably been 10 years, right?
Yeah.
I haven't been out of college for that long, have I?
Yeah.
But when I was excited to rewatch this movie, I actually bought the entire trilogy on my Xbox.
Nice.
And I'm looking forward to rewatching the other two, even though I remember really liking Reloaded, and I do remember not really caring about the third one.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it was just because I haven't seen this movie in such a long time, but I was blown away.
Yeah.
Rewatching this, I truly think this is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And it is crazy that, you know, this is the Wachowskis, it's their second film. I read somewhere that their first film, Bound, they only made it because Warner Brothers they didn't want them to direct The Matrix.
Yep.
So like The Matrix was basically their first attempt at a movie.
Yeah, they spent like 5 years formulating and writing this movie, and like hundreds and hundreds of storyboards, and they basically had this movie made in their heads before they ever got the actual green light to go ahead and make it.
Yeah. And you can tell. I mean, it's so like fleshed out, the whole world, like even though they don't really go into a lot of the details of like the Matrix and really like the world outside of the Matrix, but like it's such a confident movie in like the writing and the directing. I think I don't know if we've decided if Keanu Reeves is a good actor or if he's a bad actor yet.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that judgment has been laid down, but I think this movie, he's great in The Matrix, but only because I think Neo is a very, I think this is a role that doesn't ask a lot for him.
I think that he was perfectly cast. That is the best way to put it. Like, I don't know if this improves my opinion of him as an actor, but it makes me think that the casting of him in this role was genius.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I gotta say this, for me, this movie definitely holds a lot of weight. I had seen it within the last 5 years, and so I knew kind of going into this watching that I was gonna probably love it again. I think in the last episode though, you had brought up the question of if we were watching this with a specific eye on judging Keanu Reeves' performance and role in the film, if we wouldn't have a little bit different opinion of it. But I think we both just kind of explained how we feel about that. Like it I don't think it has improved either of our opinions of him necessarily as an actor, but yeah, it the movie is absolutely better off for him being in it. I cannot imagine anybody else playing that role now.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, so when I first saw this movie, this was probably the second R-rated movie I had ever seen in my life. I was actually a little bit sheltered as a child, and I saw most like R-rated movies at a friend's house, and we saw this like on VHS in my friend's basement, and I freaking loved it. I didn't know anything going into it. I had no preconceptions, knew nothing about the story or anything, and fell in love with it. And then it ended up being the first movie I ever saw on DVD at my uncle's house on his surround sound entertainment center.
Oh, damn.
And that was a pretty magical experience too. It was like watching the movie for the first time almost, because VHS is, you know, does not do this movie justice.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, I have two very, very specific memories of just watching this movie as a child, and like not just connected to the movie, but like it being the first DVD I ever saw. It was pretty incredible seeing a movie could look that good when you're not watching it in a theater, you know? So I definitely had a lot of baggage going into this, but I will absolutely mirror everything you've said. This is a classic that I cannot wait to show my children. Like, this is it doesn't lose anything with age. I was trying to find things that we could criticize, and there's only a few that I think we'll get to. But I have to point out what I think might be the most genius part of the whole setup for this film, and why it will last forever, is because it cannot really fall prey to being a sci-fi movie that becomes more and more ridiculous as technology advances. Because here's the thing.
Yeah.
The premise is sound. The idea that a virtual world could be created that could replace our own and we wouldn't have any idea that it's different. So, I mean, that's perfectly represented in this movie. But then all the technology that exists in the Matrix like perspective of the film is in 1999, because that's when the like Matrix is set to be taking place. So it doesn't matter that any of the technology in the Matrix world is outdated, because it's 1999, no matter what, like it doesn't matter. So none of it gets outdated. It's so when I realized that watching it this time, I was like, that is so genius. Like the fact that he's a hacker and like does all these crazy weird, like, at the beginning of the movie where he's like getting illicit data or something to somebody, it's like, oh, this would be ridiculous if we didn't already know that this was taking place in a simulated universe in the year 1999.
Yeah.
You know, it's just great, a great setup.
Yeah. Cause the plot synopsis, calls, well, so Neo is a hacker, or he's a computer programmer, and he leads a double life of a hacker, and he's like selling you see him sell, like, I don't even know what it is. He sells something to someone. It's never explained.
Yeah.
But then they call Trinity a hacker as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but, like, she's not like, hacking computers, you know, like normal humans are. She's, like, hacking the Matrix.
Well, but see, now this is where I might have made a realization watching it this time that I hadn't before. In the nightclub scene where Trinity meets Neo for the first time, he references how she is the Trinity, the one that hacked some big important place. And so I get the impression that she was a hacker like him in the Matrix before Morpheus found her. And that's so it's the same kind of arc that she went through in discovering what the Matrix was and being rescued from it. So I think that, yeah, the references to her being a hacker were her persona in the Matrix before she was rescued.
Oh, all right. That's interesting. I didn't catch that. Okay. Do you want to run down the story now?
Yeah, sure. Let's go through it. Most people are going to know what this movie is and have seen it before and know the main plot points. So we can kind of skip to our favorite bits and comment on them as much as we want. So,
yeah, sure. Let's get into the opening scene. And also, the movie starts off with the Matrix code, which is an iconic image of these green symbols. I don't know if they're supposed to be, like, Chinese letters.
Yeah, there's some backwards letters and numbers and some Chinese symbols, or I think there was some specific language I was looking at in the trivia, but I can't remember.
But it's like several columns of these letters scrolling down the screen, and they fade towards the bottom. And it's supposed to be the Matrix code, as the humans on the outside, how they kind of view the Matrix. And then it goes in to show Trinity, who's played by Carrie Ann Moss. And she is, I believe she's talking to Neo, correct?
Well, no, I don't think she's talking to him. I can't remember now.
Well, I thought that she was in the Matrix because she has been, like, watching Neo.
Yeah, she's communicating back to someone else who's also on the outside, I think. Oh, yeah. And they're talking about him, yeah.
Oh, it's actually Cypher.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
Who's played by Joe Pantoliano, incredible character actor. I actually just watched Memento.
Oh, yeah.
And he's in that. You've seen that?
Mm-hmm.
He's also in the Ben Affleck Daredevil movie. So yeah. I'm contractually obligated to mention that. but yeah, I recognized his voice because she's talking to him on the phone. And then police break into the building. So she tries to escape. I think they say that there's a hardline phone that's, like, a few blocks down the street that she has to get to exit the Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
The police break in, and then, yeah, as you mentioned, this is kind of the first showing of their, like, how they use wires in the movie. She, like, jumps up. It's a freeze frame, and the camera does a full 360 around her. And my mind was almost tricked because it's all practical. Like, there's no
CG thing about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there is CG, but it's the parts that you aren't focusing on are what are CG, because there's not a camera that's moving around them. It's literally like 110 cameras around them that are taking pictures sequentially. And yeah. so they, you know, mask those out and create the artificial background so that, that you can't see the cameras.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a rig that was, or it was, it's a rig that was made for this movie, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And it's absolutely iconic. They use it several times in this movie. The famous dodging the bullets is kind of what everyone knows.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, when I saw this, when I saw it, just because, I mean, every movie, if you did it today, it would just be a, two CG models
right.
that were made in a computer.
Yep.
And, you know, they just have the digital camera just swoop around.
Yep.
And I almost thought that's what it was, because I was just, my brain is just used to when yeah. I see something that's fake, you're just like, yeah, people don't freeze in the air and like, you can't move a camera like that.
Right.
So I had to almost break out of that and be like, no, like, yeah, she's just hanging on a wire,
mm-hmm.
you know, absolutely crazy. And, she escapes to rooftop, and this is when the agents come in.
Yeah, and
one of them played by Hugo Weaving, right? I think does he show up in this?
I don't think he shows up yet. But I just got to comment on how ingenious this movie is on a second viewing after you know what these things are and what this world is, like all the little details that they've included that are really only there for people who are watching this for a second time are so ingenious. And the, when Carrie Ann Moss's character Trinity realizes that there is an agent after her, that the like immediacy and fear that she experiences, you don't understand in the moment when you're watching this for the first time, because you don't know what an agent is. Like the agent looks like this suited up bodyguard dude. And you're like, what's scary about that? Yeah. Right.
He looks like a Men in Black.
Yeah. And as the course of the movie goes on, when you realize how dangerous these agents are and how crazy it is that she is being chased by one, it's like, it adds this whole other level of tension to the scene that you don't even have on a first viewing. So I love that.
Well, and this this intro is so perfect because they tell you so much about the Matrix by just showing you things. Because don't they show the agent like morphs? It like takes over a body. Don't they show that, or you kind of hear that?
Yeah, I think
that like dial tone that it makes.
Yeah, I think you hear something, but I don't think you see the morphing from a regular human into an agent just yet. They cut out like a lot of the things that you are then shown later in the film, like when she finally gets to the phone and gets out of the Matrix, or at least, you know, what we learn later is getting out of the Matrix. They don't show her doing the like crazy code disappearing thing that they show later. They only show this giant Chuck bulldozing into it, and then she's gone somehow. And so there's just this excellent amount of mystery to what's going on here, and you're not really quite sure what's happening at all. But you know that there's something kind of unnatural going on, and it lays the groundwork for all that so great.
It's a perfect tease. And there is a shot, honestly, the only things I could criticize about this movie are there are a few that I'm pretty sure there are CG shots that do not age well.
Yeah.
And there's one where Trinity jumps from a building into another building's window.
Yep.
And she kind of dives through the window.
Yeah, she's like, it seems like when they filmed it, they probably had her stationary and rotating, mm-hmm. and the lighting just doesn't quite look right. And it just, I mean, the way the shot
I'm
is
sure
composed.
It was green screened too.
Yeah, I would imagine. But yeah, the way the shot's composed is decent, but there's a little bit of it that just, yeah, you're right, doesn't quite age very well.
Yeah, it's an incredible shot.
Yeah.
But yeah, from when you can very tell that it's green screened or there's some computer trickery going on.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so she exits the Matrix. And then I believe it cuts straight to Keanu Reeves, correct?
Yeah.
You kind of see him in the apartment. Or in his apartment, he's getting like messages from Trinity, I believe, or is it Morpheus?
Yeah, who cares? Yeah.
But they kind of say, follow the White Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sees a girl with who invites him to a club, and she sees that, he sees that she has a White Rabbit tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to the club.
The Alice
Trinity.
In Wonderland reference, obvious there.
Yeah.
But yeah, very much overt and purposeful. But
mm-hmm. They go and meet Trinity. She says, she talks about Morpheus and the Matrix. And she's like, oh, the Matrix is real. You find out that Neo has been he's been researching Morpheus and the Matrix,
mm-hmm.
For months, probably. I don't think they say how long, but
yeah.
And then the next day he goes into work. He works a cubicle job, desk job, and the agents come in and kidnap him and try to interrogate him.
That whole sequence, though, with him getting the phone in the package and Morpheus talking to him on the phone and leading him around the office somehow. Like, again, we still don't know what this world is or what's going on. And the way that they're just teasing out all this stuff, like as a first-time viewer, you're wondering, how does Morpheus know where he is or where the agents are? Is he just an awesome hacker who's watching through the like security cameras or something? Like, we have no clue what's going on. And I kind of love that the payoff for that whole sequence is him actually getting caught. And that's kind of an awesome moment for his character arc too, where he's trying to escape by going out on this ledge outside of a window, and he just can't bring himself to get around a corner that's too difficult to get around, and so he just basically gives up and gives himself in. And I mean, there's an element here later where he kind of overcomes a similar fear, but it's very, very overt. He's not good enough. He can't overcome this fear, and he's not good enough. And just the way that they pay off that tense sequence with him just straight up getting caught was pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. So he gets caught, and this is the introduction of Hugo Weaving's villain character, Mr. Smith, who is an agent. He's like the head agent. He's like the leader of the agents.
Mm-hmm.
Smith is like an iconic villain.
Yes.
And I think we'll talk about this again with Morpheus, but I think that, I mean, it's instantly iconic villain. He's so simple. He's just a dude in a suit and sunglasses, but his like monotone voice that he like delivers is so like creepy and disturbing. And then the things that you later see him do are just terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you know, when you watch like superhero movies now, like, all the villains they have to like they're so complex, and not in the sense of, oh wow, what a complex character he, like,
yeah,
they have so many like sides to their character. They're complex just because they have like 10 layers of makeup on,
right?
Because they have to look evil.
Yep.
And it's like, this is like such a, you know, this whole movie is really such a, it's like a perfect example of like minimalism.
Yes.
Like how you can just have your villains are just dudes in suits that, you know, dodge bullets and stuff.
But there's so much more than that, because because like this entire film is predicated on this giant, very complicated universe, but this is such a self-contained story within that universe where we have, like, we really don't know, we don't even know after watching all three Matrix movies what exactly the agents are, but they just make themselves known as the enforcers, basically, of the Matrix, like the enforcers, like these are the guys you don't mess with. And Hugo Weaving does such a great job representing that both in his physical performance in the movie and his character and line delivery. Like you were saying, the monotone of his character, and but he also has such weird inflections that he throws in and weird pauses between words that it's just like he is chewing those scenes so hard, and I love every minute of it. I think there were several times where both my wife and I were actually laughing at his scenes, but not because his performance was bad. It's because it's because we've seen the movie before and we're so thoroughly enjoying getting to watch him again. Like, it was like this nervous laughter of like, oh my God, this is so good. Like, it was excellent.
That's what makes a great villain, is that you're enjoying how evil he is.
Yeah.
You know, because that performance is incredible, and it. I don't know. I mean, this Hugo Weaving was kind of a big actor, wasn't he, prior to this?
Yeah, I mean, he'd been in several films. I get the sense that he wasn't like a leading role in much of anything, though.
Yeah, I feel like this was kind of the stamp that made him be like the go-to villain.
Well, yeah, this, and then soon after being in the Lord of the Rings films, and this was his like very much a renaissance for him. So,
So let's get to Morpheus. The agents interrogate him. They put like this bug thing that I really don't want to talk about because it's really disgusting. it goes into his belly button, and what's that scene is not disgusting. What's disgusting is he wakes up the next day, Trinity and the entire Nebuchadnezzar team, they like get him and they extract the bug from his stomach, and that's what's disgusting.
Which, and getting to the, like, the setting of this film, you realize upon watching this a second time that what they're doing is just a visual representation of them removing a piece of code from essentially what it, 'cause this is all happening in the Matrix. It's just, they have this weird machine that they use to extract this physical bug from him. But then you, like, you have to put it in the context that none of this is actually happening. It's like that machine they use is basically a user interface that's one of them wrote into the Matrix for them to get rid of like bug pieces of code. So weird to think about that stuff, but it's so well
done. That's interesting. I didn't think about that. And I know they mention programs, and because like later when they see the Oracle, they talk about how she is a program.
Right.
But in the sequels, they go crazy about this stuff. Everyone's a program. Some people like are obsolete programs that have gone rogue, and
the mythology,
you know, and
gets
like
blown wide open.
But but like, I mean, the agents, they're basically like a firewall.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or like a virus protection program or something.
Yeah. And this bug is like what, like spyware or something?
Yeah, that basically.
And gotten into the like the BIOS of Neo or something.
Yeah, so they use a spyware removal tool.
Scan.
Yep.
Quick scan or thorough scan?
Definitely a thorough scan.
So they go to this like old, like rundown building, and they go see Morpheus. And Morpheus, played by Lawrence Fishburne, who, this is another thing, I looked through his filmography, and what did he play before? He was in oh God, I'm blanking on it. What was that children's cartoon?
Oh, geez, I don't even know.
Oh, you know.
Oh.
It's a Pee-wee Herman.
Oh.
He was, I've never really seen the show, but he was like the cowboy or something.
Okay.
Anyways, he was in that, and I think that was probably his most famous role.
Huh.
And then he was in,
I didn't know that,
Othello.
Yeah, that was, I was going to say, he was in some Shakespeare movie, yeah.
Yeah, and he played Othello in,
right,
Othello.
Yep.
And so I'm sure that just scrolling through, maybe I'm missing something, but I feel like that was his two biggest roles.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Morpheus is just like Agent Smith. He is an instantly iconic character. And Lawrence Fishburne, like, every actor in this movie is on their A game. And Lawrence Fishburne, just like, this scene of first meeting Morpheus is like, it puts Morpheus in the pantheon of like all time greatest characters, you know?
Yeah.
And just all of this like stuff he says and all this like philosophy mumbo jumbo.
Yeah.
And it's so compelling. And Lawrence Fishburne just, he just blows it out of the water.
Yeah.
He's
definitely more the thesis of the movie. And so it's, mm-hmm, I think he's a much more instantly likable character than Neo, who is really just a surrogate for the audience, you know, for like 90% of the, mm-hmm, movie. So yeah, he definitely stands higher than Neo as like a recognizable, lovable character, I think.
Yeah. And then the famous, line of where he offers the red pill or the blue pill. And then I believe it's the blue pill, correct? That is, one pill is he kind of stays in the matrix. I assume he would like forget.
Yeah. The blue pill is the one to stay in the matrix. Yeah.
Oh, the blue pill is,
yeah.
And so the red pill is, it's just a locator. It's just like a tracker so they can find his actual body,
right,
in the real world. And he says, there's another Alice in Wonderland line of, I'll show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. So Neo takes the red pill. They locate his body in the real world and they pick him up,
which might be the hardest left turn of any science fiction movie I've ever seen. The first time you see this film, like, I don't know, are you familiar with any of the promotional materials that were out about this film when it first came out?
No,
I haven't watched any of the original trailers or anything, but I would love to know if any of the real world footage is shown in the trailers. Or what context,
yeah,
it's shown in. You know what I mean? Because, like, those shots, when he wakes up out of that pink, nasty goop pod, that is, like, you're like, holy shit. Like, this is a completely different movie all of a sudden. And I'm really curious, like, how audiences reacted to that. I mean, obviously people loved the movie, but just how revelatory was that for people at the time? Or did they kind of know that there was something crazy that was going to happen before they went in, you know?
Yeah, I wonder. I'd be interested to go back and watch some trailers, because I do wonder, because it is jarring, because he also has all these like cords,
some
like
real
attached
body,
his body.
Horror, yeah.
And I mean, there's like a line all the way down his spine, and the cords just like start shooting out of his body, like, or unplugging themselves, and it's very disturbing. And then of course are they called Sentinels? The big robot?
Not these ones. Things? These were like the Hatchers, okay. I think, or I don't know. Mm-hmm. They're like the watchers over the pods to make sure people don't wake up.
Okay. But they kind of unhook him, and they must say like, oh, they must think, oh, another one's woken up.
Yep.
And they literally flush him out of the pod into like a reservoir that's probably like hundreds of miles down. And then that's where Morpheus and his ship, the Nebuchadnezzar, pick him up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you meet, and yeah, this is the first time you see, like, this is the first time you're outside of the Matrix.
Yep.
And so you meet all the, all the crew, and this basically just a huge exposition dump of what the world is like, the robots, how they enslaved humanity, made the Matrix to keep them, like, to keep their brains active so they can, like, harvest their, like, life force or something.
Harvest literally electricity to power themselves.
Oh, yeah.
But that's the part that in the original scripts they actually changed, because the original story was going to be that they use human beings as CPUs instead of power supplies, because the power supply doesn't even make sense, because you don't get more energy out from a human brain as electricity than you would have to put in as food. So the math on that doesn't work. I think they actually say they use human brains and a form of nuclear fission, which I guess is their way of kind of hand waving. But the genius part about this movie and any good science fiction movie is that it doesn't have to make sense if the premise is so strong and the like philosophical implications are so powerful that the rest of the movie can stand on that alone, you know?
Yeah. Plus they're also flying, they're flying robots. They're doing this to us. So
yeah.
I can wave away that they've found some way to harvest our energy to fuel them.
Exactly.
And also it's a way better imagery, you know, when Morpheus holds up a battery and he's like, this is what we are.
Well,
to
that
them.
Was the studio's basically that whole exposition sequence with Morpheus and Neo was basically dictated by the studio because they were so concerned that no one would understand what this movie was. And I mean, it kind of shows, but at the same time, the way they actually filmed that sequence is pretty well done. It didn't feel like I was getting a history lesson. It felt like I was, because of the hard right turn that we took to get here, I kind of liked that break and kind of the explanation, and the way it was shot and shown to the audience was pretty impactful. Like that, just that empty white space was such a cool way to show those characters interacting. So
yeah, and they tell you just enough and they don't over explain anything. Like all they have to do is show you that destroyed landscape of the surface of the earth that looks like, I mean, it looks like just like a volcano, almost like a volcano just like destroyed everything.
And if you want more information on the world and how it got that way, definitely check out the Animatrix, because that is actually a pretty great film, or series of short films, I should say.
Yes. So, and then there's a huge training montage where well, first of all, Neo essentially downloads like every fighting like style in the book, like kung fu, jiu-jitsu, and all that stuff. And then he goes and fights. It does a bunch of training missions. There's, I think you referenced this earlier, but there's a jump where he jumps from building to building. Skyscraper.
Doesn't quite make it the first time, but...
Doesn't quite make it. And that's when you find out that his mouth is bleeding after he falls, after he falls to the ground. And they say, you know, I thought it wasn't real. Morpheus says, oh, your mind makes it real.
Right. So now the stakes have been risen. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great thing to just show like, oh, I just have a little blood.
Right.
You know, to say, oh no, like you can die.
Yeah.
Then Morpheus fights Neo, which is a great fight scene.
This is where
also the first like kung fu fight scene, right?
Yeah, this is where you really start to realize that this movie is a labor of love. Like, this is maybe one of the best kung fu fight scenes made by like white Americans. It's just like their influences, like anime influences and kung fu influences and sci-fi influences, they show so well in so many different parts of this movie. And the fact that we just get this like straight up sparring match with, you know, there's no stakes. It's a, you know, dumb like training montage thing basically, but the characters involved are so likable, and the actual choreography of the fight is so good. And not to mention the fact that the Wachowskis found a way to make like traditional physics defying kung fu choreography actually make sense somehow in an actual context of the lore of the film. It's just like so genius.
Yeah, so good. So they fight. Then they re-enter the Matrix to go talk to the Oracle, who is a program, they say, who basically, I mean, she's an oracle. She sees the future.
Supposedly, and, yeah.
Yeah. And I believe it almost sounds like every time they wake someone up, or at least every time Morpheus wakes someone up, he takes them to the Oracle.
Right.
And the Oracle tells them one thing about their future.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think... the thing that she tells Morpheus is that he's going to find the one,
right,
who will bring balance to the force or whatever. And so they go to the Oracle. Also, the one thing we haven't talked about is leather was obviously a thing in our society. But I feel like it faded out of existence, and then the Matrix brought it back into vogue, right?
Yeah.
I never owned a leather jacket. I feel like I was very close, but I had a lot of friends who had leather jackets after this movie came out.
Mm-hmm.
And watching, because the entire team comes to the Oracle, and so they're all in their, you know, their uniforms. They all have different leather attire and like everything. They're decked out from head to toe.
I honestly think it's the look of this film, unfortunately, only really feels dated because of the unfortunate association with events that happened after this film, where we had a string of school shootings where the shooters took a lot of inspiration from the style of this film. And I feel like that's really, I think that the look of this film would be almost timeless, even with all the leather and steel-toed boot garbage, if it wasn't for the negative association, you know, after the fact with those unfortunate circumstances. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I mentioned that, I've heard a lot of people talking about this movie now. They've said it doesn't hold up. The frame of mind that I was going into this movie was I was kind of prepared for it to let me down, mm-hmm. which of course it did not at all. And I think one of the narratives that people are saying that this movie does fetishize guns like hardcore.
It does.
And
something that another Keanu Reeves series does as well, John Wick.
Oh,
which we'll get to.
We'll get to eventually. Okay, so back to the Oracle. So Morpheus has told Neo that he is the one, that he's going to, the one is the person, a person who sees the Matrix as it is and can manipulate it, however he wants. And also he will end up, ending the war between the machines and humans. Mm-hmm. So he goes to the Oracle, and the Oracle says, no, you're not the one.
Well, to be fair, at first she says it's like love. No one can tell you you're in love. You just know. But then she goes on to say, you're not the one. So, yeah. I mean, there's an inherent contradiction in what she says, so we're led to believe that there might be more going on here than she says.
Yes. Yeah, she implies that he's not the one.
Well, yeah, and he's the one who says it.
Yeah.
Right.
And Neo completely believes that he's not the one,
right.
That she's telling the truth, and there's no way to misread her statement. Mm-hmm. And this is also that the character arc that you kind of mentioned, this is kind of still when he's unsure of himself.
Yep.
He doesn't really, you know, he didn't make the jump. He fought Morpheus and lost. And so he's just, you know, he's the new guy.
And I don't think he wants to shoulder the burden that they're all mm-hmm. kind of placing on him.
Correct. And so he's probably relieved and kind of almost like, he's like, yeah, I knew that I wasn't the one. And before he leaves, she says that soon, he will have to decide between Morpheus's life and his own. And so he walks away. Then they go and leave the Matrix.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they go to their extraction point, and that's when mm-hmm. the shit hits the fan.
And this is when they're walking up to their extraction point. They're kind of walking up these stairs to this another rundown. I don't know if it's the same one from earlier.
It might have been, but, yeah.
Yeah. But this is the thing that has changed the feeling of deja vu for me for my entire life. I get the feeling of deja vu all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's normal or if I just get that feeling more than other people. But Neo is, they're walking upstairs. Neo looks in a room, sees a black cat run across his path. Not symbolizing anything, I'm sure. Walks up to the next floor, sees the exact same cat run across in the exact same way. And he says, huh, deja vu. And everyone's just like,
what the fuck did you say? Fuck up.
And so that's when you learn that deja vu is a kind of
glitch.
It's a side effect. A glitch of when the Matrix is changed. Usually when agents show up mm-hmm. and they're kind of morphing themselves and taking over a person's body.
I think in this case, they specifically call out the thing that was changed is that they bricked up all the windows.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, because they do run to windows and see that it's bricked up. So they rush to the extraction. And then you see police are raiding the building. Mm-hmm. We haven't really talked about the team, their team, but Mouse is the first one who goes down, who's kind of this scrawny guy. I think he was the youngest
in the team, on the team.
And the most recent, like, before Neo to get, like, awoken. He takes out, so like, woke. Two giant, like, Tommy guns and just blasts away some cops. He gets shot and killed. I think then they make it to the phone, and Cypher escapes first.
Yep.
And they're waiting for the next phone call to get, because they have to go in one at a time. And does the phone break, or is this when Cypher turns on everyone?
Yeah, he kills. Well, they had cut the line. They went to a different extraction point, so they you skip the action sequence with Morpheus fighting the agent. Because that's before they get to the extraction, the secondary extraction.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And we don't need to spend a ton of time on all this stuff, but I have to call out the specific shot that is one of my favorite shots in the whole movie, and that is them descending between the walls.
Yes.
And it's a long pan from top to bottom as all of them are descending through the walls to get out of harm's way to avoid these cops. And it's just such a cool shot. And like, you can't see any wires or anything. And it's a very long shot that goes all the way down this wall. And all of them are climbing down really slowly, trying not to make a sound. And eventually Cypher sneezes. And that's what causes them to get caught by one of the cops. And the cop turns into an agent and Morpheus busts through the wall and they have their big fight. But yeah, that sequence is great. When Morpheus is taken by the agents and everything is pretty awesome. And that kind of sets up the whole climax of the film. Like the big problem is that Morpheus has now been captured after they start to escape.
Yeah. So the agents capture Morpheus. They escape to the next extraction point, and that's when Cypher leaves the Matrix first. He kills Tank, the driver of the ship, and the person who's like calling them to like get them out of the Matrix. Mm-hmm. And this is when it's set up prior that Cypher is basically selling Morpheus to the agents in kind of a deal that he wants to get entered back into the Matrix.
Yeah.
Because he hates the real world. He turns on them and tries to get out what the Oracle said to Trinity. And it almost seems like he was jealous because Trinity's like destiny is that she's going to fall in love with the person who is the one. Mm-hmm. And so he kind of forces out that, is this true? And they don't say,
right.
They don't say that it's, that she's in love with Neo or that she's supposed to fall in love with Neo. But he just kind of says, is it true? And she says, yes. And that he almost seems like very pissed off about it. I wonder if he had the hots for her or something.
Yeah, for sure.
Something that never is talked about.
Well, he references it earlier how when she's bringing him breakfast, he's like, I don't remember you ever bringing me breakfast after they got me out, you know? You can tell there's a little animosity there. But yeah, it's the scene where we're establishing or where Cypher is now going around and basically unplugging everyone one by one. And yeah. It's a very tense scene that it again just kind of gives you a little bit of insight into the universe and how it works. And like, they didn't have to tell us that unplugging you would kill you. They just showed it to us, and it's horrifying. Yeah. Absolutely horrifying. Like, and this is where Switch has her very iconic death sequence. Apoc dies, and then Switch dies. But the way she looks at Trinity as Trinity's talking to Cypher on the phone and says, "Not like this," it just like that fucking hits me hard every time. And it's been memeified, but goddamn, is that a powerful scene?
Oh, yeah. So good.
Yeah.
Tank kills Cypher and they escape, and it's the genius of that scene of them showing you how they die if they get unplugged is because you then find out that the agents have taken Morpheus because they're trying to get access codes to Zion,
right,
which is the big human city, which would basically let the machines just storm the city and kill everyone. Mm-hmm. So Tank says, we have to kill Morpheus. We have to pull the plug on him so Zion is saved.
Right, so they can't extract the codes from him.
Yes. And then, boom, the Oracle's prophecy has come true. Neo has to choose between risking his life to save Morpheus or letting Morpheus die. And he decides to enter the Matrix again and save Morpheus. And it leads to what people have said is this is when the movie fetishizes guns. And I would not disagree, because this is the giant gunfight in just like a hallway.
Yeah,
a
hotel or a building lobby.
A lobby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's upon watching it this time, I was very much aware that they are ostensibly just straight up shooting innocent people. Like, those are, I mean, yeah, they're just employees or security people. They're not agents. And
yeah,
like, they're just other people who are connected to the Matrix, I would assume. And so that part got me a little bit. I was like, wow, this is a little weird when you think about it in that context. But yeah, I mean, I guess the argument is, what else were they going to do? You know, how else True. Could they possibly rescue Morpheus?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's not set up that that they're programs, right, like the agents.
Yeah,
because they're just people.
Yeah.
They're just, you know, and yeah, I did notice watching this. I think it's an incredible scene, but it does seem like since they're not evil, they're not the enemies,
right,
they're just security guards, mm-hmm, that this did just seem like, hey, we're going to do an awesome gun shootout. It's going to be super sweet.
Check that box.
And,
yep.
Yeah. And you're all going to love it, and it's going to be cool.
Yep.
So after this scene, they steal a helicopter, right?
They steal
a helicopter.
They get up to the roof, and this is where we have the fight scene with an agent for the first time, where Neo finally faces an agent. This is right before the helicopter. And we get the iconic bullet time dodging sequence with Neo, and then the very quotable "dodge this" from Trinity.
Yes.
And they actually best an agent, which is pretty badass.
Yeah. And then right after that, she says, "How did you do that? You move like them."
Yeah.
And this is kind of Neo kind of gaining his superpowers and kind of realizing that maybe he is the one. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he believes it yet or not, but this is kind of when you see his abilities, his true power come out right. of him. So they steal the helicopter, they go up, Morpheus gets interrogated, and they basically blast the side of the building with a Gatling gun.
Yeah, and just to lay some more praise on the portrayal of Agent Smith, that monologue with him and Morpheus is like the single most defining scene of Agent Smith's character, where he describes human beings as a virus of the earth that needs to be wiped out. But yeah. So they use the giant Gatling gun on the helicopter to rescue Morpheus, and he makes his way out to the helicopter. And then we get what might be one of the greatest helicopter action sequences of any movie I've ever seen. I have to call out this specifically because one of my favorite things in an action movie is when the action is treated as a surprise for the audience instead of being telegraphed. Because so many action movies will telegraph a sequence so that the audience feels a sense of tension because they know what the characters need to do to rescue themselves, but they're just basically like shouting at the screen, like, grab the thing, do the thing, like, save yourself. But in this sequence where we end up with Trinity in the crashing helicopter with Morpheus and Neo safe on a roof with all that they have between them is this rope that's connected to the helicopter. And you see Neo grab the rope, like, what the fuck does he think he's going to do? Hold the helicopter from crashing? And then when you realize that Trinity inside the helicopter shoots the line to disconnect it from the helicopter and grabs a hold of it so that, like, just understanding that the two of them are thinking the same thing in that moment, and it's a surprise to you as the audience, and you're like, oh my God, like, such a great action movie moment. And it treats the audience with intelligence and surprise instead of just like drawing it out forever. I really love that sequence.
Yeah, it's incredible. And the shot of the helicopter going into the side of the building, and you see Trinity swinging like basically towards the camera. That's a pretty incredible shot.
Yep.
So then, so Neo has saved Morpheus. Neo and Trinity have saved Morpheus, and Morpheus is in full belief that this proves that Neo is the one. And Neo still seems to believe that he believes that he's not the one, and that he tries to tell Morpheus what the Oracle told him, but Morpheus doesn't let him. They escape to an extraction point. Morpheus leaves, and Trinity leaves, and right as she leaves, an agent enters in and shoots the phone.
Yep.
Leaving Neo trapped to have to find another extraction point. And this is when Neo and Agent Smith finally duke it out.
Shoot out at the OK Corral.
In a pretty incredible fight scene. It's kind of a shootout first, and it ends with just another one of those 360 shots where they are shooting at each other, and then they land on the ground with each of their guns pointed at the other person's head, and they're out of bullets.
And then it's kung fu time.
Some great martial arts fighting. Then Neo escapes. He runs through like a crowded street, finally makes it to another phone, and is attacked by agents again. And this is when he gets shot and killed.
Yep. Fulfilling the prophecy, by the way.
Yes. Whose prophecy?
The Oracle gave him that either he or Morpheus would die.
Oh, damn. You're right.
Yeah.
So he dies, and then we should say that there's machines are attacking the ship.
Yeah, the Nebuchadnezzar. So yeah, the Sentinels are attacking them. So there's this twofold, like, crazy situation going on where we're jumping back and forth between the real world and the Matrix, where Neo's in danger in the Matrix and they're in danger in the real world, and the Sentinels are cracking open the hull of the ship. And yeah, just in time, Trinity kisses Neo to bring him back to life in what might be probably the dumbest moment of the movie.
Oh, I still loved it, though.
It is pretty great, but if there's anything that they've spent so much time establishing so many things in this movie, but I did not buy the establishment of them actually being in love. But that's a very minor nitpick on my part.
Mm. Yeah, this is when they finally reveal that the Oracle told Trinity that she would fall in love with the One.
Right.
And it almost seems like she has slowly fallen in love with him prior to the movie starting.
See, and that's
that's
what my wife pointed out too, that like she might have developed an infatuation with him because they were following his every move and, you know, observing him from, outside the Matrix. That does kind of make sense. So,
but yeah, they fall into the problem of they have to keep it a secret so they don't have time to like develop
right.
it. But yeah, so she tells Neo that she loves him, and then true love's kiss unlocks Neo's final stage, and he wakes up and stands up, and then he just like straight up murders the agents. Like, he stops bullets.
Yeah, in a great moment of foreshadowing too, where earlier in the film Morpheus implies something to Neo, and Neo's like, "What do you mean? I could dodge bullets?" And then Morpheus says, "When you're ready, you won't have to." And it's just like so great, because at the time he says that, you have no idea what that means. Even you're like, "What is that supposed to mean?" And then he literally stops bullets with his Matrix cyber mind powers.
And I think when they start shooting at him, he just like says no, and holds his hand up. And then he charges at Agent Smith and like jumps into him.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the moment that I was like, this was when they touched on things going too far.
Yeah.
Like, I think when we talk about the sequels later, I think that the sequels kind of, they're flawed only because this movie makes Neo into a god.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he jumps into Agent Smith and like blows him up. And then, like, he kills the other agents, and then he escapes. And that's basically the end of the movie, until, like, the last shot of the movie is they show him, literally flying.
Right.
Flying away.
Yeah, I mean, the Matrix movies and the sequels suffer from the Dragon Ball Z problem, where every time somebody becomes more powerful, they have to invent an even more powerful villain for them to fight, and then they become more powerful to beat that villain. And yeah, it just that problem that's created at the end of this film just completely seeps into everything that the rest of the movies have.
Yeah, but totally. I mean, it's still just in context of just this movie, it's still a cool shot of, I mean, just watching him just take off flying.
Yeah,
and it ends with the song Wake Up by Rage Against the Machine.
Yep.
And totally, like, what an amazing song to just end this movie on.
Yeah.
We've gone long. We've gone very long. But I think this movie deserves it, but let's go into some final thoughts.
Indeed.
if that's all right with you.
Yep.
I assume we're in agreement. So final thoughts. We're rating Keanu, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can throw a little bit of the movie in there, but yeah, mostly Keanu.
I kind of want to have this segment be that we're kind of just talking, wrapping up our thoughts mainly about Keanu. And I would give this four out of five Keanus, because I think even though this is a masterpiece, and I think Keanu Reeves is great in this, and I think this is proof, this is kind of the proof that Keanu Reeves is more of an action star than a, like, dramatic actor, right? Because the action and choreography, like, I guess that's probably not all Keanu Reeves, but it's incredible to watch him do action. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this movie does not ask a lot for him in terms of, you know, delivering, like, amazing lines. But he's fine, and everyone else around him is just giving their A game to this movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that just elevates his performance as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think if I were judging it purely on just having watched it once or twice, I'd say probably the same 4 out of 5 Keanus. But for me personally, in everything I know about Keanu Reeves as a person and what he brought to this film, I think I've got to one up you and give it 5 out of 5. I think this is peak Keanu. I think this is the movie that he will forever be remembered for. And that's not, and it's not because the movie was, there was something about his performance in the movie that was so memorable. It's because his commitment to the character and to what the role demanded, he just brought it. Like, I think he had several injuries throughout production. And at one point he actually ended up having like two of his like vertices fused or something. And like,
oh, yikes.
Yeah. So he was, he had to have surgery, and he couldn't do a lot of kicks in the movie because of that. And so part of the choreography limited the amount of kicks he could do. And just, I don't know as if there's a character that is more, like representative of an actor than Neo. And so I love this movie. I honestly love him in it, even though I don't know if I'll be able to say that about any of the rest of the movies in the series. I definitely 5 out of 5 for me.
Yeah, this is definitely peak Keanu. All right. So that was our talk on The Matrix. Probably easily the best movie that we'll watch in this series.
good advertisement for the rest of the series.
the discussions will be great, but I can't promise the movies will be. Not saying that they're bad movies coming up, but I do feel like this was the movie that utilized him in the best way.
Absolutely.
Like, they played up his strengths and they played down his weaknesses.
Yes.
If that makes sense. All right. I do hope you'll join us for our next movie. We'll be talking about The Replacements. Great football movie with Gene Hackman. Very excited to watch that movie. I've never seen it. I've heard a lot of great things about it, but never seen it.
Me neither.
Let's get into some recommendations. Every episode will leave you with two recommendations, not necessarily movies, but I'll go first. This is a movie that I watched about a year ago. It came out, I think, almost 2 years ago from now, I think. But it's called Green Room. It stars the late Anton Yelchin, and it is about a punk rock band is forced to fight for survival after witnessing a murder at a neo-Nazi skinhead bar. So I don't see I don't see how I could sell it any better for you.
Yeah.
It does also have Patrick Stewart in this movie as the owner of the aforementioned neo-Nazi skinhead bar. This is actually a completely amazing thriller. And there, the Green Room, the title, The Green Room, is taken from the green room of the bar where the band is kind of hanging out after they play their set. And they witness a murder happen in the green room, and they lock themselves in this room basically because the neo-Nazis have basically they think they're going to kill this band, just, you know, in a kill all the witnesses kind of thing. So a majority of the movie takes place in this green room, and then kind of around the bar as you see what was his name? I just said it. Patrick Stewart kind of comes to the bar to kind of make sure that this situation gets under control. And it is absolutely amazing. Anton Yelchin is truly incredible. Every turn this movie makes is so thrilling and horrifying, and the things that happen are pretty incredible. And I was absolutely blown away by this movie. I watched it after Anton Yelchin passed away, and it was kind of a movie that I heard a lot about, and just kind of thinking about him as an actor. I think I saw the last Star Trek movie around them too, and I was so glad that I watched this. I ended up blind buying this, so I own it, but I want to say it's on Amazon Prime now. It's been popping up on some streaming sites now. So definitely watch this. Make sure you watch this, Green Room. It's very incredible. It's, I call it a thriller, but there's some pretty disgusting stuff. Yeah. It verges on horror.
Yeah, I've seen it as well, and absolutely love this movie. So firm recommendation from me as well. I think I'm going to recommend a television show. It's been around for a few years now, called Rectify. I don't know if you've had much exposure to this.
I watched the first episode.
Okay.
And I enjoyed it, but I've never continued.
Well, I've been watching this with my wife, and this might be, after this most recent season, season 4, this might be one of my favorite shows that I've ever watched. I actually started watching this show after realizing that on Metacritic, the scores for each season have successively gotten higher every season.
Oh,
and I believe last season, season 4, ended with like a 97 Metacritic rating. So that caught my attention, and I thought, I got to check this out. And it's on Netflix. So we checked it out, and man, I'm an emotional guy, and this is one of those shows where I'm on the verge of tears almost every episode. So be forewarned that it's that kind of show. But it's about a man named Daniel Holden, a character played by Aidan Young, and he is falsely imprisoned on a murder charge, and he's serving on death row for 19 years since he was 18 when he was convicted. And his story of being he's not exonerated for his crime, in at least in the story so far, but he is released from prison basically on a technicality. And it's kind of the story about him trying to make good on the years he's lost, the stresses that have been placed on his family. And it's such a in-depth look at how something like this might play out and how people might act in this kind of scenario. But the real strength of this show is that even with a premise that strong, all the characters, not even counting the main character, the focus of the show, every single character, I think, could stand alone and have their own show that is about their a little bit more mundane life and still be entertaining. I love every actor on the show, every little subplot. It's just great. I definitely recommend checking it out. I'm really excited to see where it goes. This last season had an entire episode where the main character wasn't even in the episode, and it still was probably one of my favorite episodes of the show. So extremely strong cast and production. So
okay. I should break back into it, because it is very you said you were on the verge of tears.
Yeah.
On almost every episode. It is very emotionally draining.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's still going?
Yeah.
You've seen through four seasons?
Yep, the season going? 5, I think, starts up again in the fall, maybe, or midsummer.
Nice. I'll have to jump back into
it.
That's it for this episode of Credits Due. For Tyler Owen, I am Ben Cron. Until next time, remember always, there's a difference between knowing the path and walking the path.